frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware. I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on October 29th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to talk about the Korean War and its impact on North Korean policy, and to discuss more recent incidents of violence between the American far right and everyone else. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hi, Nate. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Bill.
So we wanted to start off this week by talking about North Korea and the Korean War in the 1950s. Obviously, this is something that's been on a lot of Americans' minds, at least with the current situation with Korea and the Korean Peninsula. It's a little bit unfortunate that, you know, instead of the focus being on, hey, the Winter Olympics are coming up and South Korea is getting to host it, like, instead, the focus is on, like, will we make it to the Winter Olympics? Not to put too fine a point on it, but... there's a lot of discussion about what the ratcheting of tensions means between the United States and North Korea and means for, you know, both that region and the world as a whole. And there seems to be a very troubling lack of acceptance in the U.S. government and foreign policy community of the fact that North Korea has nuclear weapons. They might not be able to deliver them yet to the United States, but... they have nuclear weapons. That's not really in dispute. They've had them for quite a while, and they now seem to have a fairly significant stockpile, at least for a country of that size. And, you know, they've been part of various other nuclear programs around the world for a while, so we know a lot of that technology is at least pretty functional for the purposes that we hope will never be used for. And regardless if they can hit the United States, they can certainly hit targets that are much closer. And even non-nuclear capabilities are pretty significant in North Korea. They have a very large standing army, and they have a lot of artillery, which can hit areas of the South Korean capital of Seoul without resorting to any sort of missiles or anything. You know, no nuclear weapons need apply. This is a significant reality that we need to accept and then just work from there. The strategy to keep North Korea from getting nuclear weapons failed a long time ago, and it's sort of understandable why it failed. From their perspective, of course, they are pursuing this defensively, and you can kind of follow their thought process pretty easily there, which is that, Iraq gave up its weapons of mass destruction and got rid of them and buried a lot of them in the 1990s. And then they got invaded. Gaddafi negotiated to give up his nuclear weapons program that hadn't even reached weapons of mass destruction stage yet. And then he was subsequently taken out and murdered by a Western coalition and its allies on the ground. And, you know, there's the Iran nuclear deal where they're kind of getting the rug pulled out from under them by the United States again. And all of this just kind of adds up to a pretty clear picture that there's no particular reason to trust the United States or make a deal. And so they're not going to give up their nuclear weapons. And you really can't blame them, to be honest, in that situation. But it is interesting that it is always portrayed in the U.S. media as North Korean aggression. It is always framed as North Korean aggression against the United States, against South Korea, against Japan, against whomever. And that really is kind of an incomplete picture. In addition to this sort of general feeling of needing to defend themselves from potential United States, it's important to like think about the actual history of why they have certain perspectives that they have. The North Korean regime is not good. It's pretty bad actors in general and does a lot of horrible crimes to its own population. But it's important to understand the perspective that they're coming from and the history that they are viewing this through, as well as the fact that there are obviously present day provocations that they are on the receiving end of that makes them respond in certain ways. The United States putting so-called missile defense shields in various like civilian locations in Japan and South Korea, on golf courses, on city streets. That kind of stuff is kind of threatening, and the whole purpose of it is to negate this arsenal that North Korea has been building. So obviously if their arsenal were to be negated, although the technology for missile defense really is not there yet, and that's important to stress as well, if they were able to deter that, then that would take away their defensive measures again. And again, that makes them very nervous. But also there's a lot of stuff that we're doing, like doing overflights with nuclear armed bombers and things like that. And just flying around a lot really menacingly in the general vicinity of North Korea and putting all of our, you know, ships on standby and calling up lots of potential, or issuing orders for potentially calling up lots of reservists and semi-retired military people. All of this stuff sends a pretty clear signal to the North Koreans, in addition to all the rhetoric about we can't accept a nuclear North Korea, that they are next for some sort of a major invasion. They are also justified in thinking that or worrying about that based on their experiences with the Korean War back in the aftermath of World War II. So we wanted to talk a little bit about that history. Again, this is not to say like we're justifying every action that the North Koreans take or have taken. Certainly not, but it's good to have kind of an insight into their perspectives and their view on it. The other thing is that Nate and I were talking about this right before we went on air. It's interesting that in the United States, there is so much discussion about the Vietnam War. We just did a segment a few weeks ago about Ken Burns' big documentary on that, and he's far from the only documentarian on it. That Vietnam really dominates the discourse on a lot of stuff, and in a way that the Korean War does not. And we thought that it was important to talk about some of the stuff that happened in the Korean War that should be stuff that we reflect on and that we understand that the North Koreans are considering when they're trying to figure out what they need to do to protect themselves. So on that note, why don't we get started there? I guess let's start with sort of the immediate lead up to the Korean War, which is the aftermath of World War II. The Soviets and the Americans agreed that they would go to war with Japan, which had been occupying and colonizing the Korean Peninsula since the early 1900s, and that they would divide it basically in half. And then, as happened in Germany, there was disagreement over like whether there could be a unified government between them, and they ended up getting two separate governments that didn't really recognize each other. Again, very similar to what happened in Germany, but obviously a lot more aggressive subsequently. And these were not, it was not a, you know, communists versus Democrats or whatever. It was, these were basically two fairly authoritarian regimes trying to implement a sort of vision, although the sort of communist liberation ideology probably starts out with a lot more similarities to like the North Vietnamese stuff that we've talked about before. Where do things start going wrong almost immediately in like 1945, even with the aftermath of the Korean War? Probably the Japanese officials, I think, is a good place to start, right?
Yeah, so I mean, it is interesting. We've seen when we were talking about the Vietnam example, the ways which the legacy of like the immediate legacy of the Second World War, and of course Japan's conquest of much of Eastern Asia to create their co-prosperity sphere there. But that really does affect a lot of the subsequent conflicts, whether it's in Vietnam, whether it's in, you know, Malaysia, whether it's in here in Korea. So, you know, we have seen. It is worth noting that a bunch of the U.S. Trained officials were former Japanese military officials, including people like Park Chung-hee, who would later become the president of South Korea. later. So it, and also from the North Korean side, you have people like, of course, Kim Il-sung, who was fighting alongside the Maoists in, you know, the Chinese Civil War, fighting in Manchuria against the Japanese. So, and of course,
and that becomes pretty important later when a lot of the former veterans of the Chinese Civil War come back to Korea and they're actually Koreans themselves and, you know, supporting the North Korean side.
Right. So you, and then if, when you have the connections between, as I said, Mao and the actual North Vietnamese leadership, where they're talking with each other, going back and forth, and then eventually they get reinforcements later in the war. So, you know,
also, there was a point where the U.S. very briefly tried to actually put Japanese colonial administrators in charge of the transition in South Korea, in addition to announcing that it would be a, at least a 5-year process to roll back this occupation period. And that was a huge error right off the bat. I mean, that sent a signal that the U.S. didn't know what it was doing at all and was prepared to not just put Japanese trained leadership into place, but actual Japanese sort of authorities there.
Yeah, so the Americans left the border area in 48 around the 38th parallel under the command of Kim Sok-won, who was another ex-officer in the Imperial Army of Japan. And shortly thereafter, there were border provocations and, you know, eventually the war started. So that's, yeah.
And again, I mean, it's interesting to do compare and contrast with Germany and France and that sort of situation. I mean, it would be very similar to trying to put, like, Vichy administrators directly into, and some of the guys got rehabilitated in France as well, but like if they had rolled in after D-Day and, you know, liberated Paris and been like, okay, all of the Vichy leaders who are in Paris and actual Nazis from Germany in Paris who've been running things since, you know, 1940, they're going to remain in power for 5 more years with the official backing of the Allies. That would be a horrifying prospect right off the bat. It also is, there's some similarities, of course, with the issues of, you know, denazification in Germany, that we, you know, pursued that initially and then abandoned it due to the Cold War tensions. You get similar stuff with the Japanese situation. But again, Japan had pretty brutally colonized the Korean Peninsula, and so people wanted to be done with them as fast as possible.
Right. And there's still historical memory surrounding that in terms of, say, like the comfort women. That's a very touchy subject. And in general, Japan has not been particularly forthcoming in terms of admitting its crimes during World War II. That affects relations with China as well.
I think the current, it's either the, no, it's the current prime minister, who's more or less pretty fascist in Japan, you know, and obviously does a lot of stuff to promote, like, kind of make apologies for the war crimes in the sense of not apologizing that they happened, but saying that, you know, it's fine, or refusing to apologize or whatever. I think the former prime minister, who's his, I think, foreign minister, I believe that one or both of them have, like, grandparents who were involved with, like, you know, Korean slave operations during the colonial period.
And so I was listening to a journalist who's lived in Korea for a long time and reported on the issue, talk about how for a lot of these guys, like, it's their grandfather's legacy and sort of, you know, they know what their grandfather was doing, you know, in the 40s, like, in this area. And that has a pretty profound effect in terms of just the pretty recent memory of a lot of this stuff that had happened. It is also interesting, you know, we want to talk about this a bit, Bill, just the pre-war repression of leftists and people that were feared to potentially be communists. Oftentimes a lot of students were massacred in many locations. There's the Taejon massacre and a number of other ones. Estimates have put possibly around 300,000 killed, or, you know, it's entirely difficult to actually get the exact numbers there.
Right. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of talk about the sort of North Korean repression and executions, and there certainly were those as well. But then, yeah, that we often ignore or can't even account for how many people the South Korean side killed in the lead up to the war, before the war even actually began, or as it was just beginning, of just straight up murdering people that were viewed as potential threats to the sort of consolidating power structure, which again was not democratic. Like, that's the thing that I think a lot of people really forget, is that both North Korea and South Korea, until like the 80s, had like pretty harsh dictatorships. Certainly the North Korean one is probably harsher, but that also has to do with their economic conditions and relative isolation, which is a whole kind of other story. But the South Korean dictatorship was a dictatorship until the transition period that happens over the course of the 1980s. And it's important to remember that, because if the view is presented as like we're you know, the Korean War was about saving this fledgling democracy against this, you know, communist menace that was unwilling to accept democratic control, like that's just not the reality of the situation. But, you know, eventually these tensions keep building up and building up, and the North Korean communist leadership got permission from both Stalin and Mao to undertake an invasion force. And the sort of like situation that's important to remember as the beginning of that war is that the Soviet Union was continuing to supply, like they were continuing to produce and supply major, like, you know, tanks and other type of supplies, trucks, things like that. Especially as the war developed, they had not really stopped that production since World War II, whereas the United States, like it did in the aftermath of World War I, initially tried to go back into like a, you know, okay, we're back to the normalcy, it's time for austerity, and we're going to cut all of our, you know, tank budgets and demobilize all our ships and send everyone back home, you know, if they're not participating in one of the occupations. And so by the time the Korean War starts, the North Koreans had a much larger army, many of whom were veterans from the war in China, than the South Korean army and what little sort of forces were remaining from the allies in the southern zones. The North Koreans initially did not go in with much heavy armaments or tanks and things like that, but they were able to get more of those as the war continued. But the United States really was scrambling pretty hard to try to get back to a level of wartime strength that they could. But there were like, basically it ended up being like a pretty Marines heavy war, because that was one of the, you know, units that hadn't been demobilized to the extent that other branches had been. There was a lot of like reliance on, you know, calling up Air Force planes to do bombing runs, because they hadn't completely decommissioned all of those. And they thought, oh, we'll just bomb our way out of this situation, which, as we saw later with Vietnam, really didn't work. And we'll talk more about the bombings in just a moment. But this is, again, this is sort of like the context going into this war. So the North Koreans launched this surprise attack and sort of shockingly managed to overwhelm everyone and push very far south very quickly over the course of like 1950, basically, I guess. They kind of line up to this perimeter eventually where the Allied powers under the United Nations and the United States managed to like kind of stage this stand. It definitely, like, if there hadn't been as many occupation troops still in Japan at the time, there probably wouldn't have been able to hold it at all. But that's sort of how the war initially developed. So there's this overwhelming push by the North Koreans that almost completely succeeds.
Yeah. So the United Nations was also pretty heavily involved in this war, which I think is quite unusual. You sort of think about history of the United Nations and it's mostly, you know, blue helmets somewhere in Africa or Asia doing peacekeeping, something like that. But instead, you know, they were much more heavily involved in the fighting, and there was pretty significant troop presence there in a way that we haven't really seen since, although we had a previous episode talking about the UN's emerging role in counterterrorism. So we could potentially see similar types of deployments maybe in the future, which is, you know, kind of a sobering thought. But
and this was very early in the history of the United Nations as well. This is where the term police action comes from. They were trying to say, oh, this is just a very limited war to get back to the status quo. But of course, then it snowballs past the, like, you know, the 50-50 line in the middle of the country and, you know, pushes toward China and everything. But yeah, there were like Turkish troops. There were troops from all over the world that were participating in this. And the only reason that it even happened was because the Soviet Union had a policy of boycotting the UN at the time. And so they didn't participate in the vote. And the communist Chinese government had not gotten and wouldn't for several decades get access to the seat on the UN Security Council. So everyone kind of went along with this, but it was pretty controversial at the time and was not that much repeated in future. And it was very different than a lot of the other early UN stuff, which had to do with either sorting out stuff in Israel or like trying to set up colony decolonization plans for various, you know, territories around the world. And the US like initially manages to stage this sort of comeback finally, and like did a big amphibious landing at Incheon near Seoul. And it is worth noting, though, as we're talking about this, that although the North Koreans were certainly killing opponents as they rolled southward, the South Koreans were also killing a lot of people on their way south before the sort of advance was halted and then turned back at Incheon.
Yeah, and I think it is also worth noting, you know, when we were talking about Vietnam, the phrase "My Lai" always comes up, and you know, people maybe have a superficial knowledge about that, but at least they know at least a little bit about that. But there were a number of civilian massacres in the Korean War, which are almost never talked about in the sort of the discourse here in the United States, and you know, people don't really know that much about them. And, you know, just personally speaking, I didn't really know too much about them either before doing a little bit of research about them. But I think probably the most notable one is it's called the No Gun Ri Massacre, in which a large group of South Korean refugees were killed by bombing a U.S. Air Force, and then by the 7th Cavalry Regiment as they were huddled under a railroad bridge. You know, this was in South Korea, but they were, I guess, wearing white robes, and there was a fear that these could be used to be infiltrating North Korean infiltrators, and you know, people were just, they decided to fire on them. This was a story that only came out in the late 90s, really, here in America, to the point where, and even then it was, you know, there was an AP report about it, and they were, the AP report was attacked, you know, criticized, even though they won a Pulitzer Prize for it. And people were like, oh, are they going to retract the Pulitzer Prize? Just because whenever there was a, you know, a credible news report about something the United States has done unsavory, it has to be attacked, because that is just the, you know, the way the establishment works. It needs to have this self-preservation mechanism. But even today, you can still go there in South Korea and see the bullet holes on this bridge as, you know, these refugees were huddled under it, almost making walls with bodies in order to protect themselves, as they're just being basically mowed down by the 7th Cavalry, who were told to fire by their, you know, officers. And but that, you know, that has been somewhat controversial, just in terms of, as I said, people attacking the reporting. But there have also been almost 200 other incidents that have been brought to light since then as part of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in Korea, including another incident where the U.S. blew up a bridge where refugees were coming across on it because they didn't want the North Koreans who were behind them, I guess, to be able to cross that bridge. So they just blew it up.
Right. And there were apparently thousands of people on the bridge crossing it at the time as refugees when it was blown up. And, you know, I think they only blew up part of a section of it probably, but that alone killed several hundred people. And that was in one instant, as opposed to the other bridge massacre, you know, that Nate was just mentioning, that happened over the course of several days, where people were like, you know, said to be stacking bodies trying to hide from the gunfire because the U.S. military was convinced that these people were all infiltrators, you know, hiding, posing as refugees. And I mean, there were a significant number of like major sort of refugee stories that we'll say ended better than that, but often did not. There was the SS Meredith Victory, which was like a World War II era cargo ship that was only supposed to, you know, take like a dozen passengers or so. And they were evacuating as part of the, you know, as the Southern Front was collapsing with the initial North Korean push. And they instead of outfitting it for a bunch of cargo or whatever, they ditched all the cargo, and they had their, you know, 47 person crew or something like that. And instead of taking 12 passengers in one trip, they took 14,000 refugees. So there were some, like, you know, more heroic things that happened in the war, but that's not really what people remember, especially there, and especially people in like North Korea, anybody that lost somebody is probably more likely to remember the incidents where innocent civilians were just being completely massacred. And then, you know, then later in the war, you also get the situation where the U.S. decides to push well north of the dividing line from the end of World War II, and they go all the way to the Chinese border. And the, you know, when MacArthur was leading the war effort, he was like obsessed with the fact that we were going to have to, you know, create a nuclear radiation zone along the North Korean border
belt.
And, you know, to stop the Chinese incursions or whatever. And you start getting these aerial fights with like Soviet pilots and Chinese pilots and stuff like that. And they're, you know, he's saying he's going to nuke Beijing to stop this. And there, you know, there's this very heroic Chinese effort to like, you know, protect their own border and prevent the total collapse of the North Korean state. And MacArthur is eventually fired because he was so insistent that and saying that it should be a battlefield decision, not a presidential decision on whether or not to use nuclear weapons. And Truman, you know, who had actually dropped, you know, ordered two nuclear bombs to be dropped in Japan a few years earlier, was just adamantly opposed to that. And, you know, this kind of shows you the sort of level of stakes, and the fact that the U.S. almost did use nuclear weapons on the battlefield against North Korea and in North Korea is like important to keep in mind when we're thinking about North Korea deciding that they need to have a nuclear deterrent on hand and be able to resist the United States tit for tat in, you know, on a nuclear battlefield, which is sort of horrifying to think about. But, you know, I mean, this has this huge impact. Like, eventually it kind of gets back to this impasse line. But before that, like, there's this huge effort by the Soviet supply trains, you know, thousands of rail cars being ordered by Stalin to provide more supplies. You know, the Chinese communists diverted an entire invasion plan that was supposed to go to Taiwan. Partly they were concerned about how many U.S. warships were stationed off of Taiwan, but they were going to, you know, make this final push and take over Taiwan and fully stamp out the Republic of China. And they canceled that in order to go help with the North Korean effort because there were so many Korean veterans of the Chinese communist side in the Civil War and the resistance against Japan in Manchuria. But let's talk, though, before we talk a little bit about the bombing stuff, let's talk about that late stage of the Korean War, the sort of stalemate period that happens, you know, after the first couple years. So there's like the first year where it's a real big success for the North Koreans. Then there's another year where it's a big success for the United States and the United Nations. And then it gets pushed back. And it didn't quite end up at the same line as what they had started, but fairly close in most places. But I was kind of reminded of World War One. Was that sort of your impression of it? I mean, you were talking on the Vietnam episode about like a lot of battles that seemed kind of like we have to hold this specific arbitrary point. Is there a similarity there or some distinctions?
It definitely seemed like there were a number of stalemate instances, but also, as we've talked about, the sort of the front line was very fluid. And you do actually find this at certain points in World War One. There's sort of a cliche of World War One and just being, okay, sit in trenches and never move. But in reality, that was only certain sections of the front lines and only at certain times, really. And oftentimes it was, you know, quite dynamic, and you have, you know, people using, as we mentioned, the mountains as sort of like the terrain features there. So there are definitely, I think, some similarities. And you have situations like up at the Chosin Reservoir, where U.S. and U.N. troops were up sort of quite close up to the Yalu River, and they were sort of in a sort of a stalemate situation, and then eventually retreated, you know, at great cost to the Chinese. So, yeah, I think about 40% of the Chinese combat force was disabled for about a year. So there were a number of these situations where it was, somewhat in stalemate. I think we see that reflected today with the heavily militarized border there in the DMZ.
Ultimately, the United States, like, troops lost over 36,500 people dead and then 100,000 wounded, which is a significant number. South Korean troops, they lost 137,000, almost 138,000 troops. And then there were some, you know, as I said, UK casualties, Turkish, Canada, Australia, France, Greece, Colombia, Thailand, Ethiopia. Like, this was really kind of a multinational effort, although obviously dominated by the United States. And the North Koreans, they lost You know, as many as 215,000 to 350,000 dead troops. China losing 180 something thousand. The Soviets lost about 300 people, mostly due to plane issues, like getting shot down and stuff like that, because they were secretly participating in that war. They didn't want to openly have a confrontation there and then have that boil over into a war in Europe that they weren't prepared for at that point. The other thing to remember, though, here is that it's not just about these military casualties. It's also about the fact that 2.5 million people on both sides of civilians killed or wounded during the war. And of those, you know, 990,000 or so were South Korean civilians. But even the South Korean government estimates 1.5 million North Koreans, civilians, killed or wounded during that war. And that's critical to think about when we think about the actions that North Korea takes now. And again, as Nate said, in a lot of cases, this is people's grandparents. This is people's parents. That this is a very fresh memory still, you know, 60 or so years ago at this point, that they're thinking about, like, if there's going to be another war, yeah, it's going to obliterate Seoul and millions of people will die in South Korea, but that would be defensive to prevent us from, you know, being slaughtered in these large numbers. I don't know that I agree with that logic, but that's probably the frame that's being used, and you can see where they're coming from on it.
Yeah, to further expand on the issue of civilian deaths and to talk more about Nogun Reef for a little bit, I think it was interesting to see here that in the 90s, President Bill Clinton, did a half apology.
Yeah, said regrets.
I deeply regret Korean civilians lost their lives at Nogun Reef in late July 1950. Next day, he told reporters that things happened which were wrong. Okay.
Iconic Bill Clinton line. Yeah.
And then he did not offer the apology and compensation sought by the survivors. And I guess later said, he told reporters in 2001, the evidence was not clear that there was responsibility for wrongdoing high enough up in the chain of command to say that, in fact, the government was responsible. However, in 2005, there was a historian found a declassified document in the National Archives, which basically said that on the same day, this is from the ambassador to Korea, John Mushio, telling the State Department on the day the Nogun Reef killings begun that the U.S. military, fearing infiltrators, had adopted a policy of shooting South Korean refugee groups which approached U.S. lines after firing warning shots. And there was this belief, and, you know, we've talked about the racialization during the Vietnam War episode, but there was a very Orientalist view of all Asians, all Koreans. And, they weren't necessarily, like, making these distinctions and saying, like, oh, South Koreans, like, are good, but North Koreans are bad. It's just kind of like, you know, we just need to shoot some
anybody
Koreans.
Coming yeah. at us.
Anyone
at
walking
lines,
towards
yeah.
our front lines, they could be enemy soldiers, so we may as well just shoot them.
And again, remember, this is happening about 10 years, maybe less than 10 years, after the U.S. decided to intern all Japanese population in the United States, like, west of the Mississippi. And then also, not east of the Mississippi. Like, there was a very bizarre sort of, like, you know, some Japanese people in this particular area are good and others are bad, and we're going to send a bunch of them to detention camps. And so this is sort of that policy on steroids taken to an actual battlefront. And it's you can see how that happened, and it's awful, and we should definitely apologize. But the other thing, though, is, again, if we're talking about 1.5 million North Korean civilian killed or wounded, that is talking about something much bigger scale, which is the bombing air raids. And that's kind of the thing that I want to close out this segment on, is talking about that briefly. Again, to tie it back to the Vietnam comparison, there were significant protests about the secret bombings of Cambodia when that came out. There is still much discussion. I mean, it's not as much as there should be, but there is still significant discussion about the U.S. cluster bomblets all over the, you know, Plain of Jars and all these other sites in Cambodia and Laos. There is discussion of these unexploded ordnances and just significant bombing campaigns all over Vietnam.
Not a ton in the Ken Burns documentary, though.
Right, as we talked about in that. But in general, there is at least some acknowledgement about that. Similarly, there's endless debate still to this day about World War II and the Japanese front and whether or not we should have used nuclear bombs. There's also been debates, you know, going back to Kurt Vonnegut, you know, days about whether the firebombing of Hamburg was justifiable. There was extensive bombing happening that killed many, many civilians in Vietnam, in all the surrounding countries, in the countries involved in World War II. There is not that much discussion in the sort of what little narrative there is on the Korean War about the U.S. bombing campaigns there. And again, a lot of that relates to the fact that after trying to mothball and demobilize a lot of the World War II military, the U.S. thought, well, this isn't a real war. It's just a police action. We don't have much in the way of resources and troops, so we're just going to try to solve this by bombing. And that is a very important point to keep in mind, even though it's a much, obviously, larger scale of ordnance being dropped in the Korean War. That's important to keep in mind today because the United States is back again to a position of trying to solve everything from the air and saying we aren't going to send ground troops there, or we're not going to send very many ground troops there, but we are going to have armed drones flying all over the place. We're going to have various armed fighter bombers all over the place, and we're going to solve all of these geopolitical problems from the air, these not real wars, and we're just going to bomb our way out of it. And that has clearly not worked, and North Korea should be the shining example of how much that did not work, even more so than Vietnam, because Vietnam eventually put their differences aside with the United States and has now a fairly stable partnership with the U.S. That is not true for obvious reasons, and obviously the case with North Korea. And if we're talking about 1.5 million North Koreans killed or wounded, a lot of that has to do with the United States deciding to drop more bombs on North Korea than they dropped on Japan in the entire course of World War II. And I'm not sure, it might even be more than the whole of World War II, but I don't remember off the top of my head the statistics there. And in many cases, a lot of these North Korean cities, 50 to 80% of them were being wiped out completely, and they got to a point where they ran out of targets. They had destroyed everything so thoroughly on the North Korean side, and there are firsthand accounts from people talking about how decimated North Korea was by these bombing campaigns, and it did not stop their war effort. It did not get them to back down, and it just caused massive destruction and loss of life for no point. And so then they talk about, you know, how miserably poor and everything North Korea is and how isolated it is. And it's like, well, we've economically isolated them for decades after completely reducing their much larger economy to rubble. They had a larger economy than South Korea when the war began, and now South Korea's economy is many, many times larger. That is the North Korean perspective on the situation. That is the perspective of, you guys ran out of targets so much that you started dumping bombs into the ocean to get rid of them before flying back to the bases, because you didn't want to have undropped bombs and you didn't have anywhere to drop them on targets. Like, that's the perspective that they're coming from.
I guess there was a filmmaker, Chris Marker, who visited North Korea in 1957 after the carpet bombing had ended. And he wrote that extermination passed over this land, and who can count what burned with the houses. So, you know, we have a situation where there was mass death, mass casualties. As you said, U.S. ran out of targets and just continued, just dropped. I mean, this is a similar situation in Vietnam in the sense that we were just sort of bombing to bomb and not really achieving anything strategic with it. You know, maybe there were targets. It was more of a conventional army that they were going up against. So maybe they thought that they were doing something, but it clearly did not actually turn the war around, as we've seen. So,
all right. Well, again, we wanted to just kind of provide a little bit more historical background and perspective. This is just sort of a brief overview. This is like a jumping off point if you want to go and pursue other research yourselves. But we just want to kind of like put this out there and remind folks that the North Koreans have their own perspective on this situation as well. And we need to not only ratchet down all the rhetoric and threats and everything, but we need to recognize what our actions are both today and in the past that are inherently threatening to the North Koreans of any kind, whether they're the regime or ordinary people, that the North Koreans are not generally the ones acting in an aggressive manner. They're acting in a defensive manner against U.S. aggressions, At the very least, that's their perspective on the situation. It's important to understand why. All right, Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. On some other recent episodes over the past several months, we've talked a lot about various rallies that turned violent by the spectrum of the far right in the United States, whether they're neo-Confederates, neo-Nazis, various white supremacists and nationalists, Pepe types, Proud Boys, various whatever, the far right in general, alt-right, any of these guys. And we've talked a little bit about some of the distinctions between those different groups, but a lot of times they all kind of show up in various concentrations at a lot of these events. So we wanted to do sort of a bit of an update on some of that stuff. And Nate's going to talk a little bit about what happened in Florida a couple weeks ago, whenever that was, a week or two ago, and also what happened more recently this weekend as we're recording in Tennessee. So I guess let's start with the Florida stuff since that happened earlier. That was involving Richard Spencer, the basically neo-Nazi guy, whatever, American nationalist, whatever you want to call him, who was doing a speaking event. He wasn't like even invited by the university. He was just, I think, speaking there or something. And that like somebody invited him. I don't know.
I think they reserved the space or like paid for it.
Right, right. It wasn't like a university sponsored thing. I think it's that that his group like paid to rent a space on campus or something. And then this ended up being like some hugely exorbitant, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in like security expenses and all this other stuff. And there were counter protests and everything. But talk a little bit about what happened there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw some of just the video. People were taking video from inside the lecture. So, you know, he was up on stage and people were yelling at him. And I think at one point, he started dancing. I'm not entirely clear why. So, yeah, someone asked him if whites are superior, why do you look like that? You know, sort of people were trying to go after him. But at the same time, it's also like he still got to speak there. He still got to advocate for a white ethno state. And then at the same time, it came out a couple days later that there were three arrests made of three men who had allegedly made Nazi salutes, did Hitler chants, and then shot at a group of protesters after or outside of the speech, after the speech. So William and Colt Fears, two brothers, and Tyler Tenbrick were arrested. And yeah, apparently one of them was previously sort of gained internet fame where he went to a three percenter rally, who are sort of like the militia types that go to some of these events. And I think he got like beat up by them or like put in a chokehold, and he's kept talking about like, what about the memes? Because for a lot of these guys, this is a very like internet based sort of subculture. But then, you know, compared to like the three percenter types who are out there sort of in the woods with their guns, it's a very different, there's sort of a culture clash there, which is interesting. But yeah, so these guys, they were rolling by, got out of their Jeep, were yelling, I'm going to kill them, I'm gonna shoot you, and then did shoot at them, and then they fled the scene. And one victim called the police and recited the license plate number, so they were able to locate them, and they have been charged, I believe, with murder charges or
probably attempted.
Yeah. So that's a situation there. And it was interesting, there was actually a document published that came out, but it was sort of the internal memo that the Richard Spencer, his group had, and they were sort of listing their strategy and talking about how, oh, actually the police are pretty much on our side, so they seem to know how to leverage these type of events, like if they can, if they're not overwhelmingly protested. But when there's enough police presence, they can sort of hide behind them. And that's that touches over to what we saw the past couple of days. There was a potential rally that was supposed to happen in Murfreesboro, I think, which was called off. But there was one in Shelbyville, I believe. This was very much the League of the South. And that they're sort of like the neo-Confederate types. Yeah, so they were marching down there. And they were, you know, had their a special flag, which is sort of like a black and white version of the Confederate flag. They were chanting like "White Nation, now we start the deportation," but they were also not chanting very effectively. So it was sort of perhaps somewhat less intimidating than might have been otherwise, or if they had like torches at night or something like that. But it was notable that I think in that Shelbyville case, a lot of them had helmets and shields. So as we talked about before, they sort of have these medieval type shields. And apparently a lot of the protesters, they couldn't even bring in like goggles or things like that. So as we've seen, the police are generally much more on the sides of the actual white supremacists, white nationalists, whatever you want to call them. So
I think, yeah, yeah, I mean, that reminds me, there's also been, and I don't, I'm just, this is allegations that have been made, so I'm not saying this is definitively what had happened, but in the aftermath, the continued aftermath, several months later, of the Charlottesville attack,
right, yeah,
there are allegations that the police have been basically getting eyewitness testimony from the right wing, the far right guys, to identify the opposition if anybody, you know, defended themselves. Essentially, there was, for example, the guy who used the he like improvised a flamethrower to get these guys to back off, and it was because he was literally protecting an old man, and so he lit something on fire or whatever, you know, with a canister, and like, and it wasn't hurting anybody, but it was enough to keep them away so they wouldn't beat up this old man. And video evidence emerged several days later that guy with the flaming can thing was being shot at the time. There was someone pointed a gun and was shooting. Yeah, was shooting at him at the time. And they're still, like, as I understand it, they still charged him or brought him in for questioning or something, because they're still like, they can't accept that he was acting in self-defense or protecting someone else from these actual full-blown Nazis that had were part of an event that either had just led to or subsequently led to that woman Heather being killed by a vehicle.
Also DeAndre Harris, who was beaten with poles in the parking garage, he was also there's an arrest warrant issued for him because
who knows? I mean, defending himself, yeah, like he was getting beat up, and then they're like, we should go arrest that guy. Like, that's the thing, that this pattern that keeps repeating. And then the police are like, I don't know why people don't trust us. And it's like, well, because there seems to be this pattern where people feel like you're consistently siding with these full-blown Nazi guys and letting them, you know, applying different standards to them, especially with regard to weapons and use of deadly weapons, than is being applied to literally anyone else who are often trying to defend themselves from these things. I mean, I'm not like surprised by this. I'm just like highlighting it for folks who might not have been following it that closely, that this is a serious concern that continues to build with all these different events. The other thing I was going to say, Nate, and I wonder if you could weigh in on this as well, is it seemed like maybe right after the events in Charlottesville that there was, it seemed briefly like a bit of a sea change, at least in the country, like that generally the opinions seemed to be a little bit more coming around to more of our perspective, the left perspective on this. Seems like that's already faded away. It seems like a lot of people reverted right back to like, you know, we should just debate with these Nazis and not fight back, and that they're not, you know, if we start fighting back, they'll start killing us, which again, they killed her in Charlottesville. They slashed the throats of those people in the Pacific Northwest. They're firing shots in Florida at these protesters. Like, What are you waiting for? Like, this is already here. The violence is already happening.
Yeah, well, after Charlottesville, there was, of course, the number of pieces, and we talked about this in the podcast, you know, attacking anti-fascist organizing and saying, there's zero difference between good things and bad things. And I think it is also worth noting that right after the Shelbyville rally, there was a video posted online of a bunch of these League of the South guys. They, I think, went into some restaurant. I don't know what it was, but and started an altercation with an interracial couple and pretty viciously beat the woman. I believe I've seen video of that. Her face was bleeding. So, you know, this type of violence is inevitable when these people are organizing and giving speeches and marching and things like that. So I think it is worth noting that, this is probably a continuing serious problem. It's not going to just go away if you just let them have their march. They're going to come and find you. Like, that's what's going to happen. That these people, they thrive on controversy. I mean, they, you know, they maybe have Pepe avatar. Like, I think I saw one guy with like a Pepe, like cufflink or a lapel pin or something like that. But this is very much this type of like skinhead behavior, like look for people to fight and just harass them. And so that's what's going to happen if people continue to sort of think like, oh, this isn't that big of a problem, it'll just go away. Yeah, I don't think they're really going to go away anytime soon.
The other thing that I think is interesting to consider in sort of the reactions in the months following the Charlottesville event is that at the time or shortly thereafter, there was a lot of discussion, and I think we had some discussion about it, about whether some of these so-called sort of lighter elements, you know, alt-light, that sort of thing, were going to back away in panic after the, you know, this very, very high profile fatality that this, the more extreme people caused. And initially it looked like some of them were a little bit like leery of being that closely associated with such a violent, you know, or openly violent movement. It seems like, I mean, certainly the real hardline guys didn't seem to back down at all particularly, and we weren't really expecting that. They're still going on and on about, you know, peaceful ethnic cleansing and whatever else, and like these terrifying things. But it also seems like a lot of the guys who initially kind of backed off, like they just waited a respectable period or whatever, and then went right back into saying the stuff that they were saying before and just trying to be edgy and whatever. And also, as you said, the guy who, you know, first appears in this video kind of getting made fun of by these more extreme, like right wing, you know, 3% or sovereign citizen, whatever movement they were from, like kind of getting made fun of by those guys. He then goes on in Florida to pull a gun and start shooting at people. And so this idea that, oh, the like the people who are just trying to be edgy or whatever are going to back off, and the people who are like into these ironic memes and things like that, that, you know, oh, they don't really believe this, they're just in their basements trying to get a rise out of people on the internet. Like, that seems a little naive. And this, I mean, it's not like it's a question of anecdotes versus data, obviously, but like this is a clear cut example where somebody went the opposite direction from what some people had hoped and like got more extreme and was trying to prove his credentials to these other people because he wasn't being taken seriously enough. And didn't seem to have a problem with just pulling out a gun. And you know, that they're always like couching it in this, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. And it's like, yeah, but freedom of speech doesn't involve you starting to just open fire on a crowd. Like, what? So, yeah.
Yeah, there are the internal dynamics in these scenarios where they're sort of trying to prove themselves and escalate levels of violence. I think it is also interesting. There was a story maybe about a month or so ago with some of the internal emails from Milo Yiannopoulos and his correspondence with Steve Bannon. And they were talking about how to, I think the term was, cloak their power level in order to not appear as a white nationalist and white supremacist as they actually are. But then, of course, you know, Milo's emails were like about Kristallnacht and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so
it's like passwords and things like that, all like had like the references
date that
to
King Edward the First like expelled all the Jews from England or something.
Right.
So
and that was something where a lot of people tried to portray him. They were like, no, you can't call him a Nazi, or you can't call him a this or that. And, you know, he's alt-light, he's not alt-right. And then it's like, I mean, again, maybe he's just trying to be edgy with these passwords or whatever, but like a lot of the content of this just seemed to indicate that, no, and this guy is like deeply anti-Semitic and racist and hateful and has very, very appalling views, that if we just keep letting this slide and pretending that we can look, you know, just ignore it till it goes away and not give it any oxygen, like that doesn't seem to be a viable strategy. And a lot of journalists were like outed as kind of being collaborators with him and like not taking seriously enough the fact that he was not like that. He was, this is his actual views, not this, like, it's not a jokey joke thing.
Yeah. And Milo, you know, he's relatively unimportant in the scheme of things, but the article did mention his work with Peter Thiel, and that is someone with real power and has actually a significant amount of influence now.
Yeah, that's a billionaire who's close to Trump. Like that. Right. Now we're talking serious
they
stuff.
They were sort of assessing his quote-unquote power level, and they think it's basically to the top. Like, there's not really a meaningful difference in ideology between Peter Thiel and a lot of these other guys. So that's the really unfortunate situation there.
All right. Well, on this bummer note, we're going to close out this week's episode. Just a reminder, there will not be an episode next week because for those of us around here where we're recording, it is election day for the municipal elections. And so we're going to be a little bit busy with stuff related to that. So I figure I'll take a break week. Nate, thank you so much for being here in studio to talk about these issues this week.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.